This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is September 12th, 2019, and this is episode 155. Politicoast is BC Politics Podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving a review or get at us on social media. And most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast. Thank you to our new and longtime patrons for your support. And editing services for this episode are provided by Cortado Productions. I'm Scott DeLundeboom.
And I'm Shannon Waters.
Shannon, welcome back.
Yeah, good to be on here again. Been a while.
Yes, it has. Glad you'd join us and help fill in while Ian's off on paternity leave.
Yeah.
And I suppose we should probably give a Politicoast welcome to the newest member of the family who arrived this weekend.
Yes, and is now home, I understand. So that's nice.
Yeah. So yeah, while Ian's enjoying time with the new family, we'll be covering the election call that happened, what's been happening in BC politics, and round off a couple quick takes. Finally, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter, dedicated exclusively to BC politics. You can sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature, delivered to your inbox every morning, and written by yourself, Shannon, which has always been a great benefit to us when we prep the show. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN, all lowercase, for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. Well, let's jump into our first segment. Writs are dropping like it's hot.
And the pedants are losing their minds.
Yeah, so the announcement was leaked the day before, and at least my Twitter feed was almost entirely filled up with people arguing about whether it's okay to drop a writ or not.
Yeah, I saw a lot of that too, which I don't remember from elections past. But again, well, I wasn't a political journalist at that point in time, so maybe I just missed it, or my Twitter feed was not quite as attuned to the political stuff.
Yeah, so my take on it is languages evolve. People have been saying drop the writ for many, many elections. Now, it's just how we say it in Canada, and people should get used to it.
Yeah, people understand what it means when you say drop the writ, so it seems kind of silly to argue that, you know, technically that isn't correct, but...
Well, let's get this kicked off. So yesterday, September 11th, Trudeau visited Rideau Hall, asked the Governor General to dissolve Parliament and issue the writs of election, which for the pendants out there, there's 338 as each riding gets their own.
That is a lot. I mean, 42 of them here in BC. I've been brushing up on, you know, looking at all of the different ridings and who's running where and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, 338, 42 of which I will be sort of focusing on in the coming weeks.
And naturally, local journalist Justin McElroy
has decided to rank them all. I don't know that he's done a ranking before, but he has definitely done the sort of rundown of like profiling each riding and sort of their history and what they're known for in terms of quirks, etc.
So I want to follow him for that as he dribbles them out day by day through the 40 days that are going to make up this election campaign, with voting day being on October 21st.
Yes, the BC legislature will also be back in session at that point in time, so it's going to be a very fun day for me. My colleagues in our other jurisdictions, we have Alberta today and Queen's Park today out in Ontario. Both of their legislatures will be on break until after the federal election finishes up. So,
which is probably a good thing. Or maybe not, depending on how much you don't want people paying attention to what you're trying to pass.
Well, and I mean, Jason Kenney's got campaigning to do outside of Alberta as well as inside. So can't be in the Alberta legislature while he's doing that. So,
but the first day got off to a bit of a rocky start, as I think all of the leaders kind of got a little off track when the Globe and Mail put out yet another story about SNC-Lavalin, this time that the RCMP was looking into it, and later that day it came out that Jody Wilson-Raybould had spoken to them. So then talking about what all the leaders wanted to talk about as they do their big campaign launches, a lot of the questions the media was asking was focusing on the latest news in the SNC-Lavalin
affair. I think we in the news business call that the timeliness factor, when you can drop a story on a date or in a time frame in which that makes it particularly relevant. And I think the Globe and Mail nailed that one.
They definitely did. And it ended a little badly for Trudeau that day as his plane got hit by a bus.
Yeah.
Out in your neck of the woods.
Yeah. So actually kind of a big day for BC in that two of the federal campaigns actually kind of kicked off here. Trudeau came out here pretty much as soon as he requested the dissolution of Parliament to attend an event in Vancouver in the evening. And then after that was done, he flew over to Victoria. And as the media bus was pulling away, having picked up the journalists who were accompanying the prime minister, it ran under the wing of the campaign plane and scraped it up pretty good from the pictures that I've seen on Twitter. So, you know, not the best or the warmest welcome, I guess, here in Victoria. The other campaign that kicked off here, of course, was the Federal Green Party. Elizabeth May is riding is here on the Southern Island. And so she was in Victoria as well, first thing in the morning to launch the campaign here.
Yeah, that'd be the downtown Victoria riding?
I believe hers is Saanich Gulf Islands. There is another riding for Victoria itself. It is very simply called Victoria.
Right. And that's one of the ones they're probably looking pretty closely at picking up. So it made sense to hold the kickoff meeting there.
They would be. That is my riding. The NDP candidate who previously held it, Mr. Murray Rankin, is not running. So I would not be surprised if the Greens are looking pretty seriously at trying to take it for themselves.
Yeah, I think so. It was fairly close last time. So it's definitely one they want to be looking at pretty closely. So yeah, well, Trudeau's campaign was struggling to get off the ground quite literally. And Elizabeth May kicked off in Victoria. The other leaders were Andrew Scheer was in Quebec and Jagmeet Singh was out in Ontario, I believe. There's off, but likewise, the conversation kind of got dominated by SNC-Lavalin rather than their specific campaign promises that they wanted to highlight.
Which I'm sure is something that Scheer wasn't entirely unhappy with. It does seem to be something that, you know, the Conservatives are going to sort of bang the drum on in terms of, you know, undue influence coming out of the prime minister's office, Trudeau being corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it definitely sucked a lot of the oxygen out of the room on the first day.
So that was day one. Day two also was slightly rocky as a bunch of the federal parties ended up losing candidates to various, mostly past social media problems that they've posted. And although one member stepped down from the NDP over domestic abuse allegations, so already we're seeing quite the toll. And from previous elections, we've had kind of a slow trickle of candidates stepping down as various things came out about them. But this really seemed to hit quite quickly for a lot of parties right away.
Yeah, there were a couple even before the campaign period actually begun, the Liberals as well as the NDP getting candidates to step aside due to problematic social media posts. There's one I saw this afternoon, though, that I wasn't anticipating, which was the People's Party of Canada lost or got rid of one of their candidates in Burnaby because he asked Maxime Bernier to denounce racism. And apparently that's not a thing that the PPC is interested in doing. The candidate has not actually been given an explanation as to why he's been booted, but he had asked that the party leader denounce racism and was then told that he was no longer the candidate in, can't remember which of the Burnabys, but it was in one of the Burnaby ridings.
Oh, wow. That's when you first said they'd had someone step down, I was going to crack a joke about, you know, what could be too extreme for the People's Party, but would not have guessed denouncing racism.
And the guy says he still supports the PPC. I'd only kind of like read this at the very end of my day, but I kind of wonder, like, why did you sign on with this party in the first place if you're really not on board? You know, like, I don't see Maxime Bernier wanting to denounce racism given a lot of his remarks in the past year.
Yeah, it's definitely questionable. I know a few people who, when the Bernier split off first happened, you know, looked a little bit at it, but pretty quickly noped out as it was pretty clear the direction they're going. But at this point, you kind of have to know what you're getting into to stick around this long.
I think so. But this guy apparently didn't, and now he's no longer a PVC candidate. So,
But perhaps the, I guess, most famous Etz party member right now has to be Pierre Nitel, the former New Democrat who crossed the floor over to the Greens or was kicked out of the NDP roughly at the same time as the NDP got the scoop on it and announced he was out of the party first. But he's been back in the news talking about why Quebec should separate as soon as possible and making life pretty difficult for the Green Party in the process.
Yeah, I mean, you expect that from, say, a Black Quebecois candidate, but not so much for someone who is running with the Greens. But there it is. I saw McLean's pre-rundown of the campaign that launched the morning of the writ drop. Yes, I'm going to use that phrase. And it was talking about Elizabeth May's big, weird, green tent. And I did think that that was sort of an appropriate description of what is starting to look like kind of a motley crew of candidates running for the Green Party in this election.
Yeah, that's a pretty good description. And it's a particularly motley crew because they don't appear to be doing a very great job of all getting on the same page or even vetting their candidates, because the Green Party made things a lot worse when they put out the explanation for why they have a separatist running for him. And it was because they don't actually ask about that during the vetting process because it isn't, quote, a core value of the Green Party.
And that seems to be a bit of a theme as well, with Elizabeth May's recent remarks about abortion and the fact that she would not whip her caucus on abortion issue votes. She went on to say, you know, we don't whip votes. I don't have that power as the party leader. It's not something that I can do. Spoke about her own beliefs, which is that there is a right to safe and legal abortions for people who need them. And then the party had to come out and say, well, wait a second. There's zero chance, I believe is the phrase that was used. Zero chance that Green Party candidates would vote to support restrictions on or a ban on abortion because it is one of the core values that they have to sign off on, which it kind of seems like May could have diffused the whole situation by just including that in her answer on power and politics.
Yeah, so the Green Party has a very strong core commitment, I guess, to participatory democracy and every member kind of having their say, but it leads to a pretty incoherent party. And one of the big things that parties are good at is kind of giving people and voters a set of ideas that they know, okay, if I vote for these people, this is what I'm getting. And being all over the place really doesn't actually tell you much about how they, in theory, would govern or more likely hold the balance of power in a potential minority government, which made things really difficult and probably going to turn off a lot of voters. It's especially those who, unlike the Green Party, apparently actually think keeping Canada together is one of those things that should be a core value in members of parliament.
Yeah, when you are running for a federal party and are hoping to be part of, you know, the federal conversation, if you are interested in separatism, that's maybe not the most productive attitude to be taking.
No, not at all. And this is the thing that kind of puzzles me about this is the Green Party should have known this might be an issue. Even if it isn't a core value, I think anyone who's paid even the slightest attention to politics in the last, 40 years or so, you know, knows Quebec separatism is a major flashpoint in politics. And it's best to not inadvertently get into that if you don't have to.
Yeah, that would seem like the practical approach.
Yeah, but just the Greens' way of campaigning has been very confused. And I think in what should be a good election for them, they're turning into their own worst enemy with a lot of these unforced errors.
In a lot of ways, yeah, it does seem like that. Maybe it's growing pains. I mean, you know, they have been enjoying quite a bit of success, both provincially and, you know, adding a member at the federal level. So maybe it's just kind of, you know, wobbly, new, truly federal party legs. I don't know.
I think there's a certain amount of that. Part of it's they're small parties, so they don't actually have the resources to, you know, have a lot of paid professional political people who've to point this out, although this is the sort of thing everyone, it's even unpaid and not that experienced, should know. But also, they're just getting a lot more focus now, because before it was, oh, is Elizabeth May even going to be able to get a seat? You know, maybe she'll hold on to her, the seat she has, maybe not. But now there's a real chance that the Green Party could actually be a force in Parliament, and people are looking a lot more closely at them, and the Green Party doesn't seem prepared to answer a lot of basic questions on that, and I think they've been caught by surprise with this, and a lot of it's probably growing pains.
I would tend to agree.
But I think that's probably a good segue into the story Stuart and I talked about last week, the very bizarre situation in New Brunswick, where it looked like that 14 former provincial New Democrats had decided to say, you know, screw the NDP, we're going with the Green Party. And it was a big news story that dominated a lot of last week's headlines, until it turned out that a lot of them hadn't. And earlier this week, the National Post dug into it and figured out what had happened behind the scenes. And it's mostly one disgruntled ex-candidate who wanted to be a leader of the party after the last election and kind of just made a hash of it as she tried to leave the party and join the Greens.
Reminds me of a certain former Conservative Party member who almost won a leadership bid and then exited the party and is now kind of making a mess on the federal stage.
A little bit, although this one's a little different. Unlike Maxime Bernier, who I'm pretty sure you're referencing with that, in this case, the person in question, Joyce Richardson, didn't come within spitting distance of the party leadership because she didn't pass the vetting process to put her name in for it. So when the NDP looked at it into her background when she was wanting to be leader, they found there was a bunch of complaints and disciplinary actions from the legal society she's a member of. She's a lawyer, and that they basically weren't willing to go forward with her because of this several questionable disciplinary actions that have been taken against her. Seems fairly reasonable. Although it still doesn't answer the question of how she was so involved before with the party when that was in her background. But regardless, she was refused. And then later on, within this past week or two, she started trying to get other former party members to come over and seems to have just been texting a bunch of them and kind of not being super clear with it, not actually verifying the sort of, maybe I'm interested responses that a few people gave. She took that as a yes and didn't confirm. Three of the people who she listed in the big press release from last week, turns out a mother and two daughters, and she'd only talked to the mother of the two. And from that conversation, she just assumed the others were on board. And just this weird set of circumstances where nothing actually got run down enough to even turn these maybes into a yes, but nevertheless, full national press coverage and press releases followed from that.
Yeah, the whole thing was just kind of a mess. I mean, it's nice that we have sort of a degree of clarity now as to what happened, but it took a while for that to be sort of hashed out. And in the meantime, neither the Greens nor the NDP really looked very good. You know, their actions and the way they sort of handled things, nobody really came out of that looking particularly good or well-balanced or like they'd done their due diligence.
Yeah, on the NDP side, it was a little weird that it took them 2 days to run this down. There were only 14 names on the list. In theory, they could have called all of them and had a yes-no answer ready to go within an hour or two of the news story breaking, but this thing got stretched out over most of last week. And I think a slightly more competent or on the ball back room of the NDP campaign probably should have been able to put this story to bed a lot quicker. And on the Green side, they were, you know, eager to welcome them with big press coverage and everything. And Elizabeth May talking about how great this was for the Green movement before they'd also done their due diligence on it, made sure these were actually people joining them.
Yep.
So the whole story is bizarre. It makes the kind of second tier parties, both of them, look pretty terrible. But we'll throw the link in the show notes for the story on it, because it's definitely worth a read. I think the final story we're going to talk about, and because it's definitely the funniest one that's happened in this entire both election campaign and the lead up to it over the summer is that there's another Maxime Bernier out there.
Not just out there. There's another Maxime Bernier in PPC leader Maxime Bernier's own riding.
So the Rhinoceros Party, a satirical party that's been around for a long time and famous for campaigns such as wanting to repeal the law of gravity. Well, they tracked down someone else named Maxime Bernier and convinced him to run for the Rhinoceros Party in Maxime Bernier's own riding. So there will now be two Maxime Berniers on the ballot.
And I believe the slogan from the Rhinoceros Party is, be safe, vote for both.
Which I guess is a good way to get a lot of spoiled ballots, but that's kind of the whole point of spoiling Maxime Bernier's time.
Yeah, I think they're just trying to ruin his election.
I do appreciate this, because the Rhinoceros Party is always one of those like amusing bits in the background that has been kind of quiet for the last couple of elections, but they really made a splash with this one.
It's just perfect. Perfect for this election, I think.
And finally, I guess we should point out that shortly before we recorded, there was the first debate, although not a quote-unquote the official one organized by the Debate Commission. This one was put on by Maclean's and CTV, moderated by Paul Wells. I caught most of it prior to recording, and honestly, there isn't much to say about it. Trudeau wasn't there, and none of the other leaders really shone. I think Scheer in particular needs a little more debate prep, and overall, it's probably just inconsequential.
I caught the highlights on Twitter, and I am of the same opinion.
But we'll have more debates coming. There's two official ones, one in French, one in English. That'll be happening for the English debate on October 7th and the French debate on October 10th. That one, the Prime Minister will be attending. He's also doing one more French debate. So we'll, of course, discuss the outcome of that, because that one probably actually will have some impact on the election. And before we move on to our next segment, I suppose I should ask, Shannon, what are your thoughts about the campaign so far as it's unfolding and where it's going from here?
God, I don't even know. I have a lot of anxiety about this campaign. I think there are a lot of people who are very frustrated with the governing Liberals, and I can completely understand that. I would count myself sort of among their number. And yet, unfortunately, as we've previously discussed, both the Greens and the NDP seem intent on making themselves come in fourth place rather than third, as is the toss-up. I will speak to my biases here and say that the Conservatives quite frankly terrify me. I did see someone on Twitter tonight who said that Andrew Scheer has the charisma of a stale loaf of white bread.
That's not wrong.
And then we have Bernier off doing his thing, which, by the way, in the by-elections that we had this year, of those that occurred in BC, the People's Party of Canada actually did better than it did almost anywhere else in the country. So I think that's going to be something to watch for, especially in some of BC's more rural ridings, which have had conservative appeal but may not be sold on Scheer. I think that could provide an in for the PC, which again, kind of terrifies me. I think it's going to be a toss-up. I do think we're likely to end up with a minority government, and part of me kind of just wants to fast forward to October 21st to get it all over with.
Yeah, this campaign, everyone I've talked to seems pretty unenthusiastic about it. The hardcore partisans are, of course, chomping at the bit to go out there and campaign for their people, but everyone else has been rather unenthusiastic about the whole thing, and it would not surprise me if voter turnout tends a little lower on this, and part of it is just all the options on the table seem pretty unappealing for most people.
There does seem to be sort of a sense of ennui about the whole thing. Nobody is excited. A lot of voters are kind of, or my impression is that a lot of voters are sort of looking at, you know, well, who would be the most palatable out of this very unappealing menu of voting options. I will say that I do hope people turn up. I hope people do their homework about their ridings, about party platforms, and actually do show up and cast a ballot, because it is going to be very, very frustrating if we turn out with a result that a lot of people then want to complain about, but very few people actually showed up to participate and potentially change or have had a different result happen.
Yeah, I completely agree. I should also just mention for our listeners to make sure to get your voter registration updated. We'll throw a link in the show notes for the Elections Canada website where you can do that. It's quick and simple. It took me like less than 5 minutes the other day to do, but do it because your vote does matter and it's important that everyone participates. And I guess my final question is, what is the issue that everyone should be talking about, and particularly the politicians, that doesn't seem to be getting much airtime right now?
Well, I mean, like you said, with the day one thing, I think the SNC thing in a lot of ways has played out. I think most voters have sort of made up their mind one way or the other how they feel about that issue. And continuing to bang that drum is probably not all that productive. For myself, I've been thinking a lot about pay equity. It's something that's come up in BC over the past 18 months or so. It's come up a couple times since I've been in the House. And quite frankly, I think it is well beyond time for Canada to have federal pay equity legislation that applies to everyone and that has teeth. It's 2019. Women are still not being paid the same as their male counterparts with identical or sometimes even less impressive resumes, experience, education, etc. There are other jurisdictions that have gone ahead with legislation on this front, and I'm really tired of hearing politicians talk about feminism, about how great women are and how, you know, they're going to continue to uplift women, and not talking about the very practical way in which they could change things for Canadian women.
Do you think that, I guess, particularly Trudeau and Jagmeet Singh will pivot towards that later in the election, or are you concerned it's just going to slide under the radar for the next 40 days and, well, afterwards as well?
Yeah, I would not be surprised if that's the case. I believe the NDP, and it's been a while since I looked at anybody's campaigns, but I believe the NDP does have a commitment to, you know, at least taking steps towards pay equity, but I haven't seen any sort of detail on there. I do think that the Liberals, you know, Trudeau has really kind of milked the whole feminist prime minister, gender balanced cabinet thing. And yet when it comes to trying to ensure that women are being treated fairly in the workplace and fairly compensated for their labor, I would say that what the government has done, which to my knowledge is essentially taking steps to ensure that federal employees and federally mandated employees receive equal pay, just doesn't cut it, doesn't go far enough. But no, I'm not particularly hopeful that this is going to become a major campaign issue, unfortunately.
Okay. I just in their defense briefly that it's quite hard for the federal government to do much outside of the federally regulated industries on it, although that hasn't stopped past campaigns from making labor issues a significant aspect of their campaigns.
No, and like I said, other jurisdictions, like national jurisdictions, have started to take steps on the issue. I'm actually in the process of doing some research on that right now. So it is doable. It is doable for a country to step in and say, you cannot discriminate against a very large group of people, sort of 50% of people, simply based on their gender for no reason. Like, I understand that it's complicated. Most legislation is, particularly when it's going to be very wide-ranging. But I'm just getting to the point where I don't care. I want them to fix it, and I want them to fix it soon.
Yeah, and there's a lot of very smart lawyers in Ottawa to worry about those constitutional jurisdiction stuff. So, I guess my big answer would be how Canada interacts with the rest of the world. It's getting increasingly unstable. The U.S. has become a much less reliable partner. China is becoming a lot more assertive. And there's just a lot of these international relations questions that Canada hasn't really had a good conversation about. And Paul Wells tried tonight during the debate, but nobody really has so far engaged in a serious question answer on this sort of thing. And I think it is a debate Canada really needs to have, but unfortunately Canada's really bad at having those serious debates about foreign affairs.
This is true. We just kind of coast by on our supposed nice guy reputation and expect everybody to treat us relatively well because of that. That is actually not a bad segue into the next section, though, because our finance minister is very convinced that there is a global economic storm on the horizon.
Okay, well, let's jump into that with our second segment about the BC politics news from this week. So why don't you lead us off with that?
Well, my favorite briefings are always from the finance ministry because numbers are not my strong suit and they tend to give me a headache. So we got the first quarterly report from Finance Minister Carol James earlier this week, talking about how the province was doing in its first fiscal quarter, which started in April, I believe. And it's basically a comparison for where the province's financial prospects stand now compared to where the provincial government thought they were when it announced the budget in February. And I guess one of the most significant things about it is that the finance ministry has downgraded its expected economic growth for the province. So it was supposed to be 2.4%. According to budget 2019 for this fiscal year, that's now down to 1.7%.
And this has a lot to do with anticipated global economic challenges, correct?
Yes, there was a lot of talk from the finance minister about how, like, there's a lot of uncertainty. I think she said that was one of the biggest challenges that BC is facing, and that the only thing that is certain when it comes to global politics and economics these days is uncertainty. And that's something that BC is trying to prepare for.
Yeah, that's definitely true. There's trade wars going on. Everyone's getting really concerned about the super wonky yield curve inversion that may or may not forecast of a recession. And China's slowing down their economic growth because I think they've hit the limits on the rapid industrialization and it's kind of starting to run its course. And just overall, there's a lot of uncertainty. So I can see why the government would be charting a much more cautious path.
And one of Minister James's catchphrases is prudence. She talks a lot about prudence being built into the budget. The province usually tones down its financial predictions and keeps them lower than what private sector predictions are considering for the province. So, you know, kind of not getting people's hopes up in a way, and also, you know, trying to, manage expectations while being realistic.
And that's one thing that jumped out at me is that even as economic growth is forecasted to slow down, they're still expecting a surplus, just a slightly smaller one. So it's clear that they've built in some buffer space into the budget, and they're able to fairly comfortably ride that out while maintaining a surplus.
Yeah, so the surplus is getting pretty thin at this point in time. It was $274 million when we got budget 2019 in February. That's been reduced to $179 million. Which is not a lot, but there's also contingency funding that is built in, which is basically the government trying to account for unforeseen expenses that could arise. One of the big things for BC over the past few years has been costs for fighting wildfires, which thankfully this year have not been nearly as destructive as they have in the previous two wildfire seasons. We are now past the peak, and so the government actually reduced its contingency funding somewhat, took it down by $300 million. It was very, very high at $750 million for budget 2019. Minister James told reporters its contingencies are usually closer to about $400 million or so. So we're back in sort of more realistic territory at $450 million.
Right. Although after the last couple of years of really bad wildfire seasons, I can definitely see why the government wanted to pad out the contingency fund on that. But thankfully this year, the wildfires hasn't been that bad. I think we only had, 1-2 days of smoky skies here in the lower mainland.
Yeah, and over here on the island, we didn't really get any. So, and even northern BC has had, I still have friends up in Prince George, and they said the summer was quite cool and quite rainy, which are not the kind of conditions under which you tend to get wildfires popping up all over the place like they have in summers past.
Yeah, so just a lucky year for BC on that. But climate change continues to take toll. It probably won't be going forward.
Yeah. The other thing that kind of stood out to me and was definitely something that the finance minister touted is that even though the economic growth projections were revised down, when compared with the rest of Canada, BC is still doing very well on that front. I believe for 2019, our economic growth outstrips not only what is projected for the country as a whole, but every province except for Newfoundland, which is supposed to do very well this year. Going into 2020, BC is still forecast to have the strongest economic growth of any province, beating Alberta out by a couple of percentage points. And when you couple that with the second lowest unemployment rate in the country, that's still pretty solid economic footing in a lot of ways, even if there is this uncertainty to deal with and certainly some fiscal concerns here at home.
And naturally, the opposition has taken a chance to attack the government over this. But the reality is governments don't have a huge amount of influence, or nearly as much as they think they do or like to pretend they do, over the trajectory of economic growth. And so all things considered, I'm not sure that attack's really going to land too much, especially because we are doing better than the rest of Canada.
Yeah, which is sort of the, you know, I guess the most sensible meter stick by which to measure ourselves. I believe what the Liberals came out with was that the NDP government has managed to sort of squander the very strong economy that the Liberals had left the province with to spend away this huge surplus that the province was sitting on, which frankly, I think everybody expected the NDP to do and does seem to be going over fairly well. We're building a lot of new hospitals. There's infrastructure projects going on, investments in housing, in mental health and addiction services. And we still have a surplus and are forecast to have a surplus for the next 3 years.
Yeah, they're spending down all, or not even down, but they're, yeah, spend a lot of the extra revenue that got generated because of that economic growth from that the Liberals are trying to claim credit for. So it's hard to make a really powerful argument on that.
And they're dealing with some pretty significant financial liabilities as well that are related to the way that the Liberal government managed the province. For instance, trying to get ICBC back in the black, which is a multi-year endeavor that involves some pretty drastic changes to ICBC in the way it structures its premiums, which is something we've just gone into. Those just went into effect at the beginning of September. One of the things that Minister James outlined is that ICBC is actually doing better than it was predicted to do this year, even though it's still predicted to lose tens of millions of dollars. But there are still some uncertainties as to whether the steps that the government has taken to try and right the ship there are going to be effective. There are outstanding claims that have yet to be paid out, or even defined as to what those payouts might be. And they are not covered by the new systems, which put caps on certain claims and thereby are supposed to reduce costs. One of the other things being that there are lawsuits about the changes that the government has made that could reverse those changes and also potentially result in money that the government has to return to individuals or reassess or whatever. So yes, ICBC does seem to be stabilizing in some ways, but we are not out of the woods yet when it comes to the provincial auto insurer.
Definitely not. Although it's, I guess, reassuring that the amount that we're in the red on that one starts with an M and not a B now.
Yes, for the first time in a few years.
Yeah. So those have been the kind of provincial finance numbers, but there's one number in particular that's really jumped out at me coming out of Victoria this week, and that is 93%, which turns out to be the percentage of British Columbians who responded to the daylight savings time controversy who want to see the practice end.
Yeah, they want us to stop switching the clocks in the spring and the fall, and they want BC to remain permanently on daylight saving time.
Yeah, so earlier this year, we discussed when the province released the numbers on how many people participated, and it was a whopping 223,000, making it the largest consultation in British Columbia history. And I guess people are really passionate about it and really motivated, because 93%, which is the amount that want to change it. It's a very high number. That's over 200,000 British Columbians took the time out to let the government know, which is quite a bit.
And had the same opinion. I think that's what jumped out to me, like a consensus of 93%. That's like politicians wish they could get that kind of consensus on like every other policy that exists. And they can't, they never do. But when it comes to daylight saving time, people are like, yes, this is the direction we want to go. Let's get some legislation going. Let's do this.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if Do You Like Puppies was polled would have scored better than Get Rid of Daylight Savings.
And yet now the premier is kind of playing it coy. This has been an issue that Horgan seems to enjoy talking about. It's come up every time the clock change comes around. And then he gets this sort of very strong mandate to move forward with this and basically says that we're going to wait and see what our neighbors to the south end up doing with Washington State, Oregon, and California, all considering a similar move. And I guess that does make sense. You know, it would be kind of weird for BC to sort of be the outlier in terms of not making the change. But I was just also kind of surprised that there wasn't maybe a more forceful, like, yes, we are gonna look at a legislative approach. We are going to figure out how to get this done, given the level of support.
Yeah, it seems like a really easy win for the premier. So it's a little puzzling he doesn't go forward with it. And I definitely understand the case of why it made sense to be pragmatic and not be off of the same time as our neighbors to the south. But at the same time, you can get that easy win by just putting forward some legislation when the House returns that's only comes into effect if Washington State changes their system.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens, considering it's a measure that may even have some bipartisan support. There is a Liberal MLA, Linda Larson, who has introduced a private member's bill, and I believe it's to remain on daylight savings time as well, definitely to get rid of the time change, but, you know, likely a fairly easy measure to pass.
Yeah, I have a hard time seeing the strong opposition form into this, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. But hopefully something comes forward from the government in October when they come back.
Yeah, we shall see. I'm very much looking, well, part of me is looking forward to getting back into the legislative swing of things. Part of me is dreading getting back into the legislative swing of things. We shall see.
Finally, there's some news out of the finance ministry again today. Regarding the speculation tax.
Yeah, busy week for Minister James. She was actually in Vancouver today, meeting with mayors from 25 of the 39 municipalities affected by the speculation and vacancy tax. And she took a little time out of her day to release the government's data on the issue. It's been collecting data on who is being affected by the tax, how many people are paying it, where they're from, the value of homes, all that kind of thing. So it was an interesting thing to see. As she said, or I guess according to Minister James, the tax is working as intended. And the vast majority, over 99% of British Columbians are not paying the speculation and vacancy tax, which was something that, you know, the NDP government did not want to see happen. Most of the people who are paying the tax are either foreign owners of properties or are what the government calls satellite families, which are families that are here in BC, but the bulk of their income does not come from Canadian sources. So they're not paying income tax either into the province or federally on that income.
Yeah. So overall, it's about 12,000 people paying the speculation tax. And just for some rough perspective, as of the most recent census, there's around 1,888,000 households in BC. So this is a very small fraction of the province that is ending up paying for this.
Yeah, and so the tax was implemented last year. The information that the finance ministry released covered the last 5 months of 2018. And during that time, the tax brought in approximately $58 million. Two very interesting components to that. One is that foreign owners and satellite families accounted for 45 million of that 58 million. And the other thing is that 50 million of it came from properties in Metro Vancouver. which shows that there are a lot of secondary properties that are not being occupied in Metro Vancouver, which I don't think really surprises anybody, but the proportion did surprise me, the fact that there's $50 million coming out of Metro Vancouver.
Yeah, it is a little surprisingly concentrated. This also would have captured quite a few like vacation homes and whatnot in Kelowna and a few other spots where those are quite common. So yeah, having so much in Vancouver is a little surprising.
So for comparison, if we're talking about vacation properties here, so 50 million of the 58 million came from Metro Vancouver properties. The next highest area where the speculation tax applies in terms of revenue generated on this tax was actually the Capital Regional District. So here on the island, that was 3.7 million. And then the Central Okanagan came in at a little under $3 million for vacation properties in the Okanagan.
Right. So yeah, it kind of basically follows the trend of largest metro areas downwards, which I suppose makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I was a little surprised that the Central Okanagan wasn't higher, as you said, being a popular vacation destination.
Yeah, it's a little surprising. So since the province has come in and introduced a lot of these measures, the top end of the market has definitely cooled, which is part of the effect of this. Although with such a relatively small amount of it, I'm wondering if this is as much from kind of the psychological impact on people in the market rather than the direct kind of share of the number of houses being affected.
Yes, and part of me wonders, so the government is taking the position that the tax is having a moderating effect on the housing market in the areas in which it applies, in that it is deterring speculation. And so homes are being treated as homes rather than as investments. But so far, they don't really have a lot of data to back that up. As you said, there has been sort of a marginal price drop over this past year so far. But the other thing that I kind of wonder is whether they're ever going to be able to say, yes, this is what the speculation and vacancy tax did, because there are so many other measures going on at both the provincial and the federal level when it comes to housing. We have foreign buyers tax. Vancouver has its own vacancy tax. And actually, Trudeau on the campaign trail today announced that if we end up with a Liberal government after October 21st, they will introduce a federal vacancy tax.
And they're also increasing the cap on how expensive properties can be for their first-time homebuyers loan thing up to $800,000. Yeah, so that's going to bring in a lot of new condos and whatnot here in Metro Vancouver. So at the same time, they're kind of trying to tamp down on demand and shooting it upwards as well. So it's going to be really hard to disentangle everything should that come in.
Yeah, in the end, I think there's going to be too many confounding factors for them to actually be able to say, this is what the speculation and vacancy tax did. And part of me wonders if something that Minister James and other members of the government have said about the speculation and vacancy tax is that it is going to, one, curb speculation, and two, increase vacancy rates, because it gives owners of secondary properties an option. If you're renting out your secondary property for at least 6 months of the year, you are exempt from the tax. What we haven't seen yet, and the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation will release its new numbers on vacancy rates next month, but we haven't seen vacancy rates changing like by a, you know, particularly noticeable amount. They're still very tight in Kelowna, in Vancouver, in Victoria. So part of me wonders if Minister James will come to regret sort of emphasizing that aspect of the tax instead of saying, look, we don't think it's fair that people own multiple properties in this province, in these markets that are very difficult for people to get into and where low vacancy rates and the high cost of housing are driving people away and are making it difficult for businesses to hire employees.
Yeah, we don't have numbers on how many people rented out their second places as a result of this, but like the number of people who are paying the taxes, it's something, but that's not enough to boost the Metro Vancouver vacancy rate into a kind of healthy 3-5%, which is what's ideal. So there needs to be a lot more coming down the pipe in terms of just getting new rentals into the market, besides adding just some of the old rentals back in as well.
Now, one of the things, or the thing, that the revenue from this tax is supposed to do is it's going to be redirected to affordable housing initiatives in the communities from which it is drawn, which sounds like a good thing. And to me, that seems like a better aspect to be emphasizing. The problem is that even this year, when the tax rate for foreign owners and satellite families quadruples from 0.5% to 2%, the tax is only expected to bring in about $185 million. So that's not going to make a big dent in affordable housing either. It will help, particularly if the government can potentially use it to sort of coax along or support projects that it thinks will be particularly effective. But it's a drop in the bucket in terms of the provincial and even some municipal budgets.
Yeah, you realistically, to build out any number of affordable housing units to really make an impact, it's going to need to be in the billions of dollars. And that just isn't coming down from the sort of revenue.
That $185 million is for the whole province. Like, that is the whole pie that has to be sliced up and shared between 39 municipalities that are affected by this tax.
Yeah, and even a fairly cheap new unit of social housing costing at least $100,000 a unit, so that doesn't really get you even 2,000 new social housing units. And maybe that could be spread out by kind of subsidizing a bunch of them partially, but yeah, it's just a long way from being a direct solve to the problem. But, you know, every little bit helps.
Yes. So overall, I'd say the speculation and vacancy tax is looking pretty good after its first year. It's certainly not a complete disaster. Although, as the Liberals point out, it hasn't really had a drastic effect on the housing market yet. And there are people who are unhappy with it. Mayors in some of the affected municipalities have been very vocal about their opposition to it. But a lot still remains to be seen whether it will have the effect that the government has said that it is going to have and that it wants for it to have.
Moving on to quit tates. Catherine McKenna, the environment minister at the federal level, is getting a security detail because she's been the subject of significant harassment and threats both online and in real life.
Which sadly is fairly, like, I think any female politician in nearly any role at this point in time would be familiar with. Catherine McKenna does seem to attract just a lot more vitriol than even your average female politician in a prominent role. I have a feeling that's tied up with her role as environment minister and people being very sort of polarized on that issue a lot of the time.
She definitely seems to draw a lot more of that ire and harassment than any of her other colleagues in the federal cabinet of either gender.
Yeah. And I'm not entirely sure why that is. I always find it really disappointing when I see stuff like this, because I would like to think that thinking adults can disagree on policy and still treat each other like human beings. But there seem to be a lot of people in our society who are not capable of doing that. And so now our environment minister has a security detail.
Moving on to our next story, Manitoba's had their election. We talked about this briefly when it was called, and unsurprisingly, Brian Pallister's Progressive Conservatives won a majority. They were widely expected to. Overall, the seats didn't even shift much. They lost two. The NDP gained two to Britain. Theirs up from 16 to 18, and the Liberals lost the seat. But overall, just not much has changed in Manitoba. The results came in Tuesday night, which I think probably has something to do with why the federal election was called the day after, just to give Manitoba time for them to do their election before things kicked into gear nationally.
Yeah, that was not a race. I mean, obviously, when it was called, was aware and kind of read a few things. And then, yeah, like you said, most people expected another mandate for the PCs. And that's pretty much what Manitobans delivered.
Yeah, so it's hard to read much into that in terms of what it means federally, although I've definitely seen some people try, but
I guess it keeps, there's a very solid sort of wall of conservative leadership in Central Canada, like spanning all of Central Canada.
Although Brian Pallister seems to be less antagonistic towards the Trudeau government than some of his other Western conservative colleagues. I saw a few NDP people trying to make a big deal about the Greens not gaining any seats, but I think that just goes to the more show the level of vitriol between those two parties federally than anything you can really draw from the particular idiosyncrasies of Manitoba politics and their impact on the federal level.
I tend to agree on that for sure. This week, after much anticipation, at least on my part, the Humanist Association released an analysis of prayers said in the House between, I believe it's October 2002 and February of this year, 2019. One of the things that really surprised me when I arrived at the legislature was that each session, every day, they start the day's proceedings with a prayer delivered by one of the MLAs.
Which seems, I guess, a little surprising if you're not kind of familiar with the history of BC, because right now BC is a pretty secular society, so it seems a little odd that we'd be starting every single day in the legislature with that.
Well, and I was definitely taken aback a bit, given, you know, it's the people's house and not all of the people pray. But it's not uncommon either. BC seems to be a bit of an outlier in that the MLAs deliver prayers, but in other legislatures, it's the speaker who starts the day's proceedings with a prayer. So prayer in legislatures is not necessarily uncommon in Canada, although the ones that I'm aware of don't have individual MLAs actually deliver them.
Yeah, so out of this report, they found that most of the prayers are religious, but they were only able to identify like specific religions for about 21% of those. And I think unsurprisingly, it's predominantly Christian.
Yeah.
When they were able to tie it to a specific set.
So yeah, just over 70%, I believe, were deemed to be religious. And the criteria are not overly broad, I thought. Religious prayers include prayers that quote, say, from a religious text, mention a specific deity. Most prayers, even the secular ones, actually closed with amen. But simply using amen, which many people would recognize as being, you know, sort of a religious closing or finality, didn't make the prayer be classified as religious if the rest of its content was purely secular. I was a little bit surprised because my own perception was more like half and half, or maybe two-thirds of prayers are sort of suggestively religious. One thing that I found that was interesting is that even as fewer MLAs have been participating in prayers over the years, the religious ones have been getting longer. So they tend to be longer than the secular prayers do in the House, which to me was kind of interesting. I've heard the Lord's Prayer recited in the chamber. That one definitely set my head spinning a little bit. But I've also heard some really sort of, there's been some really poignant moments in the chamber that have involved prayer. The one that sticks out in my mind is Municipal Affairs and Housing Minister Selena Robertson delivering a Jewish, I believe it was a prayer or a statement during prayer from the Jewish faith. After the synagogue shooting that took place in the States, I believe it was last year. And that was a really poignant moment in the House, and one that I don't think most people who are either not Jewish or not religious would sort of have a problem with. Given the predominance of religious prayers, though, I'm not surprised that there are potentially a lot of people who are kind of uncomfortable with the fact that these prayers take place in the House every morning.
Yeah, and the report ends by making several recommendations, including abolishing opening the practice of sittings with a prayer, and recommend that it be replaced with nothing or a First Nations territorial acknowledgement or a time for silent reflection.
Yeah, which unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, depending on your perspective, I don't really see happening. Legislatures are not prone to change on a whim, and practices that are entrenched often tend to stick around. That being said, the acting clerk is currently reviewing the standard prayers, which are sort of provided to members as a guide or options for them to use if they're participating in the prayer giving, to try and make them more inclusive and ensure that, you know, there's sort of some balance there. That being said, MLAs don't have to use those prayers. I don't think they are really, there's sort of any restrictions that are placed on them when it comes to prayers, aside from potentially timing.
Yeah, and in fact, something that stood out to me was that 10 of the prayers they reviewed had overtly partisan content in there.
Yeah, some of the things that people have prayed for are kind of weird. Like I said, most of the time when MLAs pray, they're asking for people to reflect on sort of the seriousness of the job and the service that they provide to British Columbians and, you know, let us do good work and that kind of thing. But some of the things that people have prayed for, I'm just kind of shaking my head.
So we'll throw a link up in the show notes for that if you want to take a look at some of those things that lead to head shaking about... There are some interesting ones in there. Yeah, I know Ian put a lot of work into getting this done for his real job as the director of the Humanist Association, so do give it a peruse. And finally, before we close off the show tonight, Shannon, can you tell people where they can find you?
Well, if you are looking for my work, it is on BritishColumbiaToday.ca. You can sign up for a 2-week free trial there. There are also a few stories that I've done over the 2 years now that I have been writing BC Today. There are a few stories that are not behind a paywall. So if you're curious as to what I write about when I'm not just having to cover legislation and the goings on in the House, you can find that there. If you like your political coverage in bite-sized form, I am on Twitter at BC Today Official. And if you're more of a fan of general opinion, feminist hot takes, the breakdown of the hold music on government teleconferences, and pictures of my cat, you can find me at So Bitter, So Sweet.
Look, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to everything we talked about at politicos.ca. For a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Social Plotnikov. Thanks for listening.